Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today on this blustery March morning, and it's March Madness Day. I want everyone to note that there is orange in my scarf. I made an effort. I looked in the closet. This was the best I could do because I know today at noon there's a basketball game, I heard. So we'll enjoy that. A couple of announcements. I want to remind you that we are looking for nominations for the TMR Volunteer of the Year Award, and those nominations are due at the 8 a.m. on March 29th. So you can mail them in, email them in, or hand them to me. And there's more information on the website and also in your email address, email inbox, I should say. I also wanted to give you a heads up, and there are some flyers, and you'll all be getting more information about a two-part lecture series that University College is co-sponsoring with Lemoyne on the future of medicine. It's a little bit different. One lecture on genetic testing and what we call personalized medicine, and the other on narrative medicine. That's later on in the spring, April 25th and March 2nd. So do look out for that if you are interested in sort of future of medicine, alternative medicine. Next week, March 15th, at the Institute for Retired Persons, I thought you might be interested in this, Alan Rothschild of the Rothschild Companies, who I think this is so special. He has a patent museum. He's a patent model collector. And a number of his patent models are on two-year loan to the Smithsonian. If you've been there, I think they went up about a couple of months ago. Actually, I was in December, and it was just opening, and it's going to be there for 2 years. He's going to be at IRP talking about the whole patent model thing and bringing some of his collection there. So I highly recommend that. Here at TMR, we will have Julie Cecil from the McMahon-Ryan Child Advocacy Center, which recently moved into where TMR used to meet, Reed or Peck Hall at the old UC. So, but we're talking about that issue, of course. Just want to point out TMR members in the news, Marianne Raffaro, and also, again, Arlene Abend in this month's issue of Syracuse Woman. So it's great that we have all these different media outlets and we can read about all the great things that community members are doing. Today, though, it is my pleasure to welcome Thomas Keck. Professor Keck is the Michael O. Sawyer Chair of Constitutional Law and Politics in the Department of Political Science at SU. He's also the chair of that department. He has written widely. His most recent book is called The Most Activist Supreme Court in History, The Road to Modern Judicial Conservatism. He's also currently writing a book on the courts and the culture wars during the Clinton, Bush, and Obama eras. It's been a few years since he's been with us, so I'm very glad that we could snag him back to talk about the Supreme Court of the United States and the 2012 election. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks so much, Sandra, for that introduction, and thanks to you all for coming out today. It's been I don't know, 5 or 6 years since I've been here, and I'm happy to be back. And as Sandra said, she's asked me to talk about the Supreme Court and the election, which I'm happy to do. Throughout its history, the Supreme Court has regularly been the subject of significant political controversy, and those controversies have tended to spike at election time, for obvious reasons, with partisan candidates trying to use the court for political ends, and with the justices themselves sometimes exacerbating this tendency. And if you look over the broad sweep of this history, there's really three principal ways in which the court has become involved in elections. And so I thought I'd say a little bit about each of those three ways today. First, the justices sometimes interfere directly with electoral rules and procedures. That doesn't happen often, but it does happen. Second, presidential candidates sometimes call attention on the campaign trail to the likely vacancies that are going to occur on the court and say, vote for me, because this is the kind of Supreme Court justice that I'll appoint. And third, the court itself sometimes issues controversial decisions in the midst of an election year that have the effect of reshaping the political agenda and debate while the election is ongoing. So let's take those three categories in order. So first of all, the court sometimes does indeed interfere with electoral rules and procedures directly. The most obvious example of this, of course, is the 2000 election controversy from Florida, right? Bush versus Gore, remember that, where the Supreme Court actually decided the outcome of the presidential election. This hopefully is not going to recur very often. The court deciding the outcome of the presidential election by a 5-4 vote, et cetera. So at that direct level, it's unlikely to happen this year or any other year. But in other ways, the court does sometimes get involved in altering the rules by which campaigns and elections are conducted. For example, if you think back to a decision that many of you have probably heard of from a couple years ago, Citizens United versus FEC, the Supreme Court declared for the first time that corporations and labor unions were allowed to spend unlimited amounts of money advocating the election or defeat of a particular candidate. And it's that decision that has given direct rise to the super PACs that are playing such a large role in the Republican primary so far this year and are likely to continue to play a role in the general election this fall, right? So if you've been following the Republican primary, right, the super PACs, if not for the super PACs, the Republican primary would probably be over by now, right? Mitt Romney had dramatically outraised all of the other Republican candidates in conventional fundraising, right, for fundraising direct contributions to his own campaign. But both Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum have had a small number of very wealthy supporters who have been able to funnel unlimited amounts of money, not to their campaigns directly, but to these so-called super PACs that are technically independent of the campaigns, but that their sole reason for existence is to conduct television advertising, advocating the election of these particular candidates, and most of those ads tend to be negative ads criticizing the merits of the other candidates. So because of those super PACs, which were authorized by the Supreme Court in Citizens United versus FEC, the Republican primary is playing out differently than it might otherwise have played out. And these super PACs are likely to continue to play a significant role this fall as well, right, where you will see on both sides, right, you will see millions of dollars spent by a small number of corporations and wealthy individuals advocating the election of defeat of Mitt Romney or Barack Obama this fall. Besides campaign finance, the other main area in which the courts get regularly drawn into tinkering with the rules by which campaigns and elections are conducted, the other main area has to do with redistricting. And the Supreme Court has gotten drawn into this a little bit already this year as well, so I thought I'd say a quick word about this one. Right, so as you may know, right, every 10 years we conduct a national census where we get an accurate count of the population in every state, and one result of that census every 10 years is that congressional districts have to be redrawn, right? New York loses a seat, right? Other states where population has grown more quickly gain a seat. Populations shift from place to place within a state. So in order to keep the districts of approximately equal size, they have to be redrawn every 10 years. And this, if you pay any attention to this, you'll know this is an intensely partisan and political process, which is in serious need of reform. Right here in New York and throughout much of the country, the way this works is the district lines are drawn by the state legislature, right? And the explicit goal of the process by which they draw these lines, right, is to protect incumbent members of their own party. It's instead of voters choosing their elected representatives, you have elected representatives essentially choosing their voters, right, using sophisticated computer mapping technology that goes down to the level of the city block, right, to carve out particular neighborhoods where they know that they have a lot of support based on past elections and draw those district lines in ways that will allow incumbent members of their own party to maintain their hold on power. And for the most part, the courts don't have that much to do with that process. It's mostly, in most states, it's conducted primarily by state legislatures. But there's a couple ways that courts tend to get drawn into it. And the most notable one, just because it happens the most frequently, is that in states that are covered by the Federal Voting Rights Act, which dates to 1965, and which says, among other things, that states in the South, which had a history of denying voting rights to African Americans, states in the South are not allowed to make any changes to their electoral rules or procedures without getting permission first of the Federal Justice Department. And the idea here was that the Justice Department would make sure that these states aren't changing their voting rules in such a way as to harm the voting rights of African Americans or other racial minorities. And so every time the redistricting process happens in a state that is covered by the Federal Voting Rights Act, there are often allegations that the lines have been drawn in such a way as to harm the interests of African American voters or Latino voters. So there's been, and that often results in litigation, which means the courts get drawn into figuring out where these electoral district lines should be drawn. And in a case from Texas, the Supreme Court this year has already gotten drawn into one of these conflicts. So the Republican-controlled state legislature of Texas Texas got a couple extra seats this year because there's been a lot of population growth in Texas. Republican legislature in Texas drew a set of lines that was widely described in the press as favoring the interests of Republican congressional candidates. Advocates for Black and Latino voters in Texas went to court, and they argued that this was this new districting map was inconsistent with the Federal Voting Rights Act. It had packed African American and Latino voters too tightly into a small number of districts, thus diminishing their influence on a broader array of House elections in the state. And a federal court agreed with them and ordered a new map to be used where the federal court redrew the district lines. And it was widely reported in the press that this map drawn by the federal court was likely to result probably in a net gain of 4 seats in the House for Democrats as compared to the map that had been drawn by the state legislature. Well, the state legislature appeals that decision, and it goes to the Supreme Court. And in the decision a couple months ago in January, the Supreme Court threw out that new map and ordered the lower federal court to try again. They didn't order them to go back to the original map drawn by the state legislature, but they said it had to be somewhere in between or somewhere closer to the map drawn by the state legislature. Texas's primary election has been delayed as a result of this litigation, and it's now been pushed back to May, I believe, is what they're saying now. But the direct result of this Supreme Court decision, this is not what the justices say they're doing, this is not the legal logic of the decision, but in terms of its impact on the election, the direct result is to give a small boost to Republican House candidates from the state of Texas by erasing the map that had given a little bit more of a boost to Democratic House candidates. And if partisan control of the House of Representatives this fall hangs on a small number of seats, these kinds of legal disputes could turn out to have an impact on who takes control, right? Because remember, this is just one case. This is the only one that the U.S. Supreme Court has gotten drawn into, this one from Texas. But similar litigation is going on in multiple other states, and the federal courts have been weighing in on those decisions as well. And so the overall result can be an impact on a not insubstantial number of seats. So that's just sort of one set of ways in which the court sometimes gets drawn in to tinkering with the electoral rules themselves, right? Sometimes they count the votes themselves. Sometimes they make decisions that influence who's allowed to contribute money to campaigns. Sometimes they make decisions that influence where electoral district lines are drawn, which can have an effect on the outcome of the campaigns. So that's the first category. The second thing I'd like to mention is this might be the one that we often think about if you say, well, what's the role of the Supreme Court in the presidential election? Well, this has not played a prominent role in the primary so far. But this fall, I can assure you that both Barack Obama and the Republican nominee, who's likely to be Mitt Romney, both of them will say on the campaign trail this fall, vote for me because the fate of the Supreme Court hangs in the balance, and my opponent will appoint justices who are crazy and do the wrong thing, and you should vote for me instead because I'll appoint the right kind of justices. And they'll be speaking to different groups of people, and they'll have different code words that they'll use, and they'll mean different things regarding what kind of justice they're going to appoint, but they're both basically saying the same thing, right? So Romney will say, vote for me and I'll appoint justices who are strict constructionists, or I'll appoint justices who will exercise judicial restraint, or I'll appoint justices who are like Justice Scalia and Thomas, which is what George W. Bush used to always say on the campaign trail. He's like, well, my favorite justices are Scalia and Thomas, so I'll appoint justices like them. Whatever kind of code words Romney chooses to adopt, it'll be something along those lines. And Barack Obama will say, vote for me, I'll appoint justices who will preserve Roe versus Wade, defend the right to choose, who will, if you look back to the 2008 campaign, Obama sometimes said things like, I'll appoint justices who are willing to stand up for the little guy against big corporations, right? He'll have some probably subtle criticisms of Citizens United if he talks about the court. And I should note that these kinds of arguments will come from the presidential candidates. I guarantee you they will say these things, something along these lines, whether or not they really care that much, right? I don't think Mitt Romney or Barack Obama actually cares all that much about the Supreme Court, right? If you ask them to list what are the top most important things that the president has to do in the next 4 years, they both have other issues they would like to talk about more, whether it's unemployment and the economy or national security issues or the like. But given the commitments of key members of the partisan base for both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, given the commitments of key members of those partisan bases to certain fundamental questions that the Supreme Court plays a prominent role on, such as abortion rights, presidential candidates are essentially obligated to make some promises to the electorate about what kind of justice they will appoint when they're elected. And there's really nothing wrong with these promises, right? I mean, it is true that President Obama and President Romney would appoint different kinds of Supreme Court justices who would issue different kinds of decisions. So to the extent that they are giving us information that is more or less clear and accurate about what those justices would look like, that's helpful for the voters to know. There's nothing wrong with these promises. Really, the main grounds for criticism of the presidential candidates on this point is that they simply tend to exaggerate the stakes, right? So if you go back to the 2000 election, both Al Gore and George W. Bush talked about Supreme Court appointments fairly regularly on the campaign trail, and Al Gore kept saying, the next president over the next 4 years will appoint at least 3 and maybe 4 justices, right? And it turns out over the next 4 years there were 0 vacancies on the Supreme Court. So the direct result of that election in terms of the composition of the Supreme Court was 0, right? None of the justices retired in the next 4 years. But they never say that, right? They never say that. They always exaggerate the stakes, right? The Supreme Court is closely divided. We know some of these justices are going to retire. You got to appoint me, you got to elect me, because I'm going to appoint the right kind of justice who will adhere to the Constitution as it's supposed to be understood, and not the other guy. This time around, I can tell you a little bit about, so you should take it with a grain of salt, right, when they say the fate of the Supreme Court hangs in the balance when you elect. Take it with a grain of salt. This time around, I think it's fair to say that there will be at least one vacancy in the next 4 years, and possibly more. Ruth Bader Ginsburg turns 79 next week, and she has had some significant health problems. She's doing pretty well at the moment, by all accounts, but if you project out 4 years in advance, right, so 4 years from now, she'll be turning 83, and she has had significant problems. It's not unreasonable to imagine that she might retire in the next 4 years. Now, if President Obama were to name her replacement, that would have no immediate impact on sort of the balance of power on the court, right, to the extent that the court is divided between relatively liberal justices, relatively conservative justices, with some moderate swing justices in the middle, right? Ginsburg is on the left, and President Obama is likely to replace her with somebody who would also be on the left of the court. Of course, if President Romney replaced her, that would significantly alter the balance of power on the court. So that's important. That's not insignificant. That is a potentially significant result that hangs on the outcome of the presidential election this fall. It's possible there'll be a couple other vacancies, although this starts to get more speculative. Justice Scalia turns 76 in a couple days, and Justice Kennedy does in July of this year, also turns 76. So if you project 4 years out, they'll both be turning 80 around the end of the next presidential term. They both are, by all accounts, in very good health and vigorously performing their job on the court. And we, of course, all wish them continued good health. So it's just speculation, right? Many justices in recent years have served into their 80s, but some have not, right? Some have not. When you're turning 80, right, you sometimes have health problems that makes it difficult for you to continue in your job. And so it's possible. I think Ginsburg is the most likely retirement in the next 4 years, but it's possible that either Scalia or Kennedy could follow her. Now, of course, if Barack Obama is reelected this fall, I guarantee you that both Antonin Scalia and Anthony Kennedy will do their best to hang on as long as they can. There are scholars who've studied this, and if you look at the long history of the Supreme Court, there's been 170 justices, something like that in the court's history. And if you look at their decisions to retire, the patterns are fairly obvious, right, that they do their best to retire during an administration of the same party as the president who appointed them. They don't always make it, right? Sometimes they try to hang on and they don't make it. And occasionally a justice just decides he's had enough and just retires, regardless of who's in the White House. But all else equal, they tend to try to give the vacancy to a president of the same party that appointed them. So if Obama's reelected, Scalia and Kennedy will do their best to hang on and hope that they get a Republican presidential candidate in 2016 in the White House. But you never know, right? And again, here the stakes are reversed as compared to a Ginsburg retirement. Right here, if President Romney were to replace Justice Scalia or Justice Kennedy, well, if President Romney were to replace Justice Scalia, has no real effect on the balance of power on the court. If President Romney were to replace Justice Kennedy, Kennedy is the court's swing justice at the moment, who often votes with the other conservatives on the court, but not always, right? And so, hypothetically, if President Romney were to replace him with a solid conservative vote, that would shift the court's balance of power to the right. Meanwhile, if President Obama were to replace either Scalia or Kennedy, that would shift the court's balance of power significantly to the left. So come this fall, you will certainly hear Mitt Romney and Barack Obama talk about the stakes, talk about the importance of the Supreme Court. They might talk about some particular recent and pending decisions that they think are important and how their justices would approach those decisions. Again, take it with a grain of salt, but it's not insignificant, right? Whoever wins this fall will likely get to appoint at least one justice to the Supreme Court. And remember, these justices are appointed for life, which these days often means terms of 30-some years, right? In recent years, most Supreme Court nominees have been in their 50s, and many of them have served on the court into their 80s, right? So they're going to be around for quite a long time. So those stakes are not insignificant. The third and final way, and in some ways I think the most significant way, in which the court sometimes plays a role in presidential elections is simply by issuing noteworthy, controversial decisions in the midst of an election year, decisions that draw lots of attention. Decisions that the presidential candidates themselves have no control over, right? They don't get to decide what cases come to the Supreme Court and how the court decides them, and decisions that can have the effect of putting a new issue on the political agenda or forcing the presidential candidates to respond to a particular issue when they'd rather be talking about something else and the like. And here, not just any decision from the Supreme Court will do, right, to rise to the level of actually impacting the election, it has to be a truly blockbuster decision. So if you look at the cases that are pending on the Supreme Court's docket for the rest of this year, there's lots of issues that the court's going to be deciding that are interesting to people like me, right, who spend hours upon hours every day reading what the Supreme Court's up to, right? So there's lots of interesting legal issues that the court's going to decide, but most of these don't rise to the level of playing a role in the election, right? So the court is going to decide a case involving whether local jails can conduct strip searches of all people who are arrested, even for very minor offenses. They're going to decide whether a criminal sentence can be appealed on the grounds that the defense counsel failed to tell the defendant about a plea offer from the prosecutor that he would have accepted had he known about it. He didn't hear about it, so he didn't get a chance to accept it. Then he got convicted and got a longer sentence. They're going to decide whether prosecutors can introduce DNA evidence in a criminal trial without making the actual analyst who conducted the tests available to testify at the trial and be cross-examined. They're going to decide whether the FCC's standards for indecency on broadcast television are unconstitutionally vague. They're going to decide whether the First Amendment protects someone who falsely claims to have won a Purple Heart or a Medal of Honor or some other military decoration or award. It's illegal under federal law to falsely claim that you have won one of those awards. They're going to decide whether imposing a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole on a convicted murderer who is 14 years old violates the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment. All of those are interesting questions. I encourage you to follow what the court's doing and see what answers they give to all of those. None of those are going to impact the presidential election, right? The court does lots of things that are interesting and significant, and on the day that they are decided, we'll get a small amount of national press coverage, depending upon what the court says. But there's really only two cases, just two cases on the court's docket this year that are significant enough to potentially play a role in the election this fall. And both of them, interestingly, have to do with the balance of power between the states and the federal government. And let me say a couple of quick words about one of them and then some longer words about the other one. So the first case is the immigration case from Arizona. Some of you may have heard about this, right? So 2 years ago, the state of Arizona passed an unusually strict immigration law, which, among other things, makes it a crime for undocumented immigrants to apply for a job in the state or to be in the state without valid immigration papers. It authorizes law enforcement officers to arrest anyone whom they have probable cause to believe may be subject to deportation, a provision that critics of the law have alleged that this will lead to racial profiling by law enforcement officers. What is it that's going to give an officer probable cause to believe that somebody is subject to deportation in Arizona? Presumably it is possible that it's going to be because the person looks to be Mexican. And so there's been multiple legal challenges filed against this law, including one filed by the Obama administration. And the longstanding position of the federal courts historically has been that immigration law is primarily a matter of federal control, right? Congress is expressly authorized in the Constitution to regulate matters of immigration. And historically, the federal courts have tended to say that state governments are not allowed to pass laws which sort of interfere with the operation of whether the federal government is doing a good job or not of regulating immigration, that it's within the province of the federal government, and that states are not supposed to interfere with that. Now, if the court sticks with that longstanding view, it will strike down all or at least some parts of the Arizona law. And if that happens, it is likely that Mitt Romney will yell and scream about the decision, right, and complain about the activist judges on the Supreme Court thwarting the will of the people of Arizona who have stepped in and tried to pass a law that they think is necessary to solve the problem of undocumented immigration that the federal government is failing to adequately address and the like. On the other hand, if the court switches course from its longstanding approach to state and federal power in the immigration context and upholds the Arizona law, which I think is a possible outcome, this gets a little bit speculative here, but I think it is easy to imagine a path by which the court upholds the Arizona law that leads Some other states have already copied Arizona's law, but the fact that those laws are all held up with ongoing litigation, and if the court says that these laws are in fact constitutionally legitimate, it might well prompt some other states to enact similar laws. Which one likely effect of that, I think, would be to prompt there's no guarantees, but to be an impetus for the federal government to restart its efforts to enact some form of comprehensive immigration reform, right? So President Obama, since the 2008 campaign, has said that he's in favor of comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level, and it hasn't gone anywhere yet, partly because it's an intensely divisive issue and it's very difficult to get folks in Congress to agree on what to do about the problem. But if Obama is reelected, and if you have multiple states copying Arizona's highly punitive approach to immigration law, I think that is likely to be a significant impetus for the Obama administration to try to do something again, right? So if this decision comes down, you might see Obama on the campaign trail promising once again, right? I know I promised it in 2008, we haven't gotten it done yet, but promising once again to get Congress to tackle what everybody concedes is a fundamentally important issue that Congress has failed to address in recent years. So that one, depending on what the court says, could well play a role in the election. The second, and even bigger one, which I've saved for the end, is the healthcare suits, right? This is really three separate cases that have been consolidated together, which raise a host of different legal questions about the constitutionality of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which was signed by President Obama 2 years ago. But the gist of the argument is as follows, right? There's a bunch of different subsidiary legal questions, but the main argument, which is an argument that's been advanced by the Attorney General of Florida and a number of other states, is that the individual mandate provision of the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. The individual mandate provision is the provision of the new federal law that says that all persons must have health insurance. The argument advanced by Florida and other states is that this exceeds the scope of congressional powers under the original Constitution. Now, if you think about this for a minute, I'm not a health policy expert, but to understand the question that actually the court is faced with in this case, you have to veer off just for a second here to think about what the Affordable Care Act is all about and what the Obama administration and Congress were trying to do, and therefore what it is that the court is being asked to potentially invalidate, right? The existing healthcare system is a mess. Right, it's widely described as both as having costs that are too high and quality and access to care that are too low. Right, there are more than 50 million Americans who lack health insurance altogether. Costs in the healthcare industry as a whole have for years been rising substantially faster than inflation in the rest of the economy. The industry now consumes 18% of GDP in the country, right? 18% of the size of our national economy is devoted to the healthcare industry. And if you think about just these basic facts for just a second, it would seem odd to me if the national government were somehow not allowed to regulate this industry. Right, the industry represents 18% of the national economy. Right, surely either the federal government is constitutionally authorized to regulate this industry, or something is wrong with our constitution. Right, what kind of constitution is it that would create a national government that is not allowed to regulate a fifth of the national economy? Right, that would seem somehow problematic. So if Congress is allowed to regulate the healthcare industry, there are basically two ways to do it, right? There's two broad ways to do it. One, you could have a national health insurance system, right? This is the way that most advanced industrial democracies do it, right? The federal government provides healthcare to all residents in the country. That's one way. The other way is you work with our existing system of private insurance and impose a stricter set of rules and regulations on how that existing system works in a way to try to sort of jerry-rig a system that can provide insurance to everybody at an affordable cost, right? So you impose some strict limits on the ability of insurance companies to deny coverage or deny care to people when they're sick, right? You impose a mandate that everybody have health insurance to avoid the problem of free riders, right? You don't pay for health insurance, but then you get sick, you go to the emergency room. And you create an extensive system of government subsidies to help people who would not otherwise be able to afford the insurance, to help them afford it. This is what the Affordable Care Act does, right? Those are the three major provisions. And if you pull out any one of those provisions, the rest of it falls apart, right? You can't mandate that insurance companies provide coverage to all comers, right, if you don't also require everybody to have health insurance. Because then any rational person would avoid buying health insurance until he got sick, right? And the insurance company would be required to give it to you, right? That's not going to work as a sustainable business model. So the individual mandate is a central component of the effort by the federal government to regulate an industry that represents 18% of the national economy. But the state of Florida argues that it's unconstitutional. And so this is one of those great cases that raises a giant and consequential issue of contemporary public policy, right? How are we going to provide health insurance at an affordable cost to millions and millions of Americans who don't currently have it, right? Huge stakes involved. And at the same time, raises fundamental questions that are age old, right? That are 200 and some years old about the nature of our constitutional system, right? So the way that the lawyers and judges talk about this issue doesn't have anything to do with who doesn't have health insurance and who needs it and how much costs are rising and the like, right? They don't care about any of those things, right? They're talking about the original meaning of the Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, right? So when these cases, they're scheduled for argument at the end of this month, and the court has devoted 3 full days of oral arguments to these cases, which is unprecedented, right? That the modern court typically devotes 1 hour to each case that it hears. The court has devoted 3 days of arguments to these cases, and there's a bunch of different complicated subsidiary questions. But the basic question is whether Congress has the power to impose this individual mandate. And you're going to hear discussion, if you follow the press accounts of these cases when the arguments happen in a couple weeks, you're going to hear discussion of famous landmark decisions from throughout the court's history. There'll be discussions of McCulloch versus Maryland, which was a decision in 1819 in which Chief Justice John Marshall declared that the federal government had the constitutional authority to create a national bank. There is nothing in the text of the Constitution that says explicitly that Congress can create a national bank, but Congress did so anyway, and Chief Justice John Marshall wrote a famous opinion for the court saying it's okay. The words of the Constitution have to be interpreted broadly and flexibly, John Marshall said. he said, we are not called upon to interpret the detailed provisions of a tax statute, which might lay out in all particulars every question that we might expect to arise. No, we are called upon to interpret the fundamental charter of our government, right? His quote is, we must never forget that it is a constitution we are expounding, a constitution intended to endure for ages to come. When what Marshall meant by that, right, is that if the Constitution is going to endure for ages to come, it was because the framers wanted it to endure for ages to come, they intentionally wrote it in ways that were open-ended, right, that created a new and more powerful national government which would have powers that were flexible and adaptable enough to respond to the various crises that might emerge in future years. That's what John Marshall said in 1819. That case is still taught in law schools to this day. It's one of the court's landmark original interpretations of the scope of federal power. And if you read Marshall's opinion in that case and, you know, do your best to translate those words into 200 years into the future, which is a difficult task that lawyers and judges have to do, Marshall's approach seems to give the court, that seems to give Congress plenty of room to enact a national health care law. You'll also hear discussion of some early 20th century cases from the Supreme Court. For example, there might be some discussion of Hammer versus Dagenhart, which was in 1917, I believe, 1918. Hammer versus Dagenhart was a case in which the court said that the national government was not allowed to regulate child labor. The national government had no constitutional authority to ban or otherwise regulate the practice of child labor. right? As you may know, in the early 20th century, there was a widespread problem of kids being pulled out of school to work in factories because their families needed the money. This, of course, undercut the wages of adult workers, made it harder for them to get jobs in the same factories. It obviously was bad for the kids. It obviously would be better for society as a whole for those kids to be in school learning to read than working in a dangerous factory. And Congress repeatedly responded to widespread public demands by passing laws that regulated practices of child labor. And the Supreme Court repeatedly, Hammer versus Dagenhart's the most famous one, but there was a couple other cases too, Supreme Court repeatedly struck these laws down, said they're beyond the scope of federal power. Now, the way these cases are usually talked about, certainly the way they were talked about in 1918 when they came down, is that these are crazy decisions from the Supreme Court, right? What is the court doing? The court is either misreading the original Constitution, or maybe it's reading the original Constitution correctly, but it's imposing such a strict version of that original Constitution onto contemporary realities, which have changed over the course of the past century, right? The men who wrote the Constitution were not faced with large industrial factories, right? They had not been invented yet. So they didn't address the problem of whether Congress could regulate child labor in large industrial factories. Either way, the Supreme Court is going too far in limiting the powers of the national government and preventing it from responding to important national problems. This line of decisions culminated with a set of famous cases in 1935 and 36, in which the Supreme Court struck down multiple pieces of New Deal legislation, right? Laws enacted by the Democratic Congress and signed by FDR during his first term, attempting to get the nation out of the Great Depression and in the meantime to protect the most vulnerable amongst us during the Great Depression. And the court repeatedly struck these laws down, right? Imposing a strict conception of the limits of the powers of the national government. 1936, of course, was an election year. FDR won in a landslide. Democrats won majorities in both houses of Congress that were the largest of at any point during the 20th century. The court was forced to retreat, right? And in some famous cases in 1937 and the following years, the Supreme Court changed its mind and decided, well, okay, yeah, it's okay. The national government can pass these laws after all. And there was a whole wave of subsequent decisions upholding New Deal laws. Social Security Act was upheld. The National Labor Relations Act was upheld. The Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the federal minimum wage and maximum hours law, was upheld. Supreme Court backed down, right? The court's strict enforcement of what the public took to be outdated constitutional limits on the powers of the national government in the midst of an election year was rebuked by the public at the polls, right? FDR and congressional Democrats won a landslide reelection running on a platform of we want to enact more of these laws just like the ones that the court has been striking down. We don't agree with the court that these are unconstitutional. Vote for us. We will enact these laws again. And one way or another, we'll figure out a way to get them past the Supreme Court. If the current Supreme Court is not careful, right, a decision striking down the Affordable Care Act could look like those decisions from 1936. Right? Think about this. This could conceivably be a substantial gift to President Obama and the Democratic Party. Right? Democratic presidents since Truman have been trying to insure the uninsured, right? Trying to provide figure out some way for the national government to provide health insurance to all people throughout the country. Truman tried it and failed, and every Democratic president since then has made at least some effort in this regard. Obama finally gets it done, right? And then the Supreme Court strikes it down by a 5-4 vote. Really? Right? Based on some 200-year-old conception of the proper limits of constitutional power that appears to suggest that the national government is absolutely prohibited from enacting any effective regulation of 1/5 of the national economy? Right? President Obama, will stand up that very day on TV. He'll criticize the decision. He'll say, you got to vote for me, and you got to vote for Democrats in Congress. We're going to fix health care again. We're going to figure out a way to get it done, and we're going to figure out a way to get it through the Supreme Court. Right? A decision striking down Obamacare would potentially have an enormous impact on the election this year. But here's the thing. I think John Roberts knows this, right? He's a smart guy, and he's a student of the court's history, and I think it's unlikely that he wants his legacy to be defined by a case that is reminiscent of the widely discredited decisions from the Supreme Court in 1936, right? This would be the case that defines his legacy. He's a young guy. He's in good health. He's going to be on the court for decades to come. Maybe something else comes along that's bigger, but it's hard to imagine, right? This is going to be the case. If he strikes down the law, this is going to be the case that defines his legacy. And historically, when the Supreme Court has posed a direct and fundamental challenge to the President of the United States, the Supreme Court has not usually won, right? Over time, the powers of the White House are bigger and stronger and more extensive than the powers of the court, right? Eventually the justices retire and the president gets to replace them, right? And when the Supreme Court has posed a fundamental, sharp political challenge to the president, the court has not usually won, right? And John Roberts knows this, right? So if he doesn't want that to happen, right, he has two options, right? He can uphold the law, is option number one, and there are substantial constitutional arguments that are persuasive to many lawyers, judges, and legal scholars, including a couple prominent, very conservative judges in the lower courts who in some of the decisions leading up to the Supreme Court have held that the Affordable Care Act is constitutional, right? So there are good legal arguments for upholding it, so that's one possible outcome. You could see 5-4, 6-3, 7-2, I don't think I'll go further than that. You could well see a 7-2 decision upholding the major provisions of the Affordable Care Act. But there is another option also. And I would not be surprised if we see something along these lines. So let me end by throwing this out there. The way we think about it is sort of in black and white terms, right? Oh, the court, you know, somebody says the law is unconstitutional and the Supreme Court has to decide, right? They have two options, right? They can strike it down or they can uphold it. Well, they really have a third option, and it's one that the court often exercises, which is to duck the question, right? They do this not infrequently, right? And you can duck the question entirely or you can duck part of it. It comes in a lot of different forms. But the justices have a variety of legal means by which they can sometimes avoid deciding the main constitutional issue that is in front of them, or at least avoid deciding it in its most expansive version, right? So I'll give you just one example of what this decision could look like. And for obvious reasons, right, they sometimes have motivations to want to do this, right? Well, if they're going to get yelled and screamed at, either of the black and white choices, right, is bad for the court, right, because partisans on both sides are so deeply entrenched, right, and the court is going to get drawn into a very divisive political conflict. But maybe if they can sort of fudge it and duck the main issue, then let's explore that option. So here's one way that they could do it. One of the legal issues in these cases is whether the individual mandate provision of the Affordable Care Act is a tax provision, right? The Obama administration has repeatedly said it is not a tax provision because if it is a tax provision, then it looks like a tax increase, right? So here's what the provision says. It says everybody in the country has to have health insurance, and if you do not have health insurance, we don't throw you in jail, right? If you do not have health insurance, you have to pay a small tax penalty when you file your taxes the next time around, right? So there will be a new question on the 1040 form that says, do you have health insurance? And if you do not, then you have to pay a small penalty. That sounds an awful lot like a tax provision. It has amended the Internal Revenue Code, right? It's going to be enforced by the IRS. It's going to be on the tax form. It looks and sounds an awful lot like a tax provision. The Obama administration politically is always saying that it is not a tax provision because it's a tax increase on people who don't have insurance. If you call it a tax, it's a tax increase, and they didn't want to call it that. But lawyers have been arguing, some lawyers have been arguing, that it is obviously a tax provision, right? It functionally operates as a provision of the Internal Revenue Code, and it's just one more example of lots of other things in the tax code, right? So that if you pay a home mortgage interest, right, you get a break on your taxes. If you don't pay home mortgage interest, you don't get the break, right? If you have health insurance, you get a break on your taxes. If you don't have health insurance, you don't get a break, right? If from that angle, it looks like any other tax provision. But here's the thing. There's a provision of federal law. It's known as the Anti-Injunction Act, which says nobody's allowed to challenge a provision of the tax code in court unless and until that tax has actually been assessed upon them. Right, you can't just run to court because you object to some provision of the tax code. If you have actually been asked to pay the tax, you have to pay it and then find your lawyer and go to court and you can challenge it. And if you win, then the government will refund the payment to you. Nobody has been forced to pay this tax penalty because it does not take effect until 2015. Right? So there is an argument being made in the cases that the issue should not even be decided until 2015. So we could well see an opinion from the Roberts Court, which does the following. Announces in sharp rhetoric all the potential constitutional problems with the Affordable Care Act, right? Criticizes the Obama administration, criticizes Congress, criticizes the law, suggests that Congress is trying to overreach beyond the powers of the federal government, endorses much of the sort of conservative complaint about the law, but ducks the issue, right? Says, we can't decide this until 2015. So come June, when the court's decision will come down, if the court does something like that, then call me up and tell me I was right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you. Questions? All right. We have time for a couple.
Issues. Three issues that occur to me that I'm asking the question. I don't know whether they're being handled by the Supreme Court or not. One is Roe versus Wade. One is the re-examination of the Citizens United Act. And one is medical marijuana. Are any of those being considered?
Not currently by the Supreme Court, but they could well come back, right? So the way the legal process works, right, is that the court will issue a famous landmark decision that gets lots of attention, but there's always a million unanswered questions, right? Well, okay, so you're not allowed to ban abortion altogether. Roe versus Wade says you have a constitutional right to choose to have an abortion, and so state laws, which are periodically enacted by states, that impose a full ban on abortion, the federal courts quickly strike those down because they're inconsistent with Roe versus Wade. But meanwhile, states pass all kinds of other subtler and more complicated regulations and restrictions on abortion, and it's not clear from Roe versus Wade whether those ones are allowed or not allowed. And so there's endless litigation in the lower courts, for example, about a different wide variety of abortion restrictions. The one that's been in the news lately is state laws mandating that abortion providers conduct an ultrasound and show the image and describe the image to the woman before performing the abortion. Those laws are on the books in several states, and several legal challenges have been filed, and a couple courts have ruled that they're unconstitutional. In general, what the Supreme Court tries to do, again, sort of avoiding controversy if it can, it's up to the Supreme Court justices to decide which cases they want to hear, right? They get to choose their own cases as they come to them. And if the lower courts are effectively and more or less consistently handling a particular issue, then the Supreme Court will just stay out of it. When the lower courts get divided, right, so if you have several federal appellate courts that say these ultrasound laws are constitutional and several others that say they're unconstitutional, then the court will agree to hear one of the cases in order to settle that conflict. So at the moment, there's no abortion cases on the court's docket. But there are cases working their way up. At the moment, there are also no campaign finance cases on the court's docket, but there are cases working their way up. The ones that have gotten the most attention are legal challenges So Citizens United sort of allowed unlimited spending by corporations on elections, but one of the things it says in that opinion, appears to say, is that laws mandating full disclosure are allowed, are constitutional, but several states have quite strict laws mandating even for small expenditures and small donations that any organization that's spending money in an election has to fully disclose the identity of all its donors. And some donors don't like that. They'd prefer to be able to donate giant amounts of money and do it secretly. And so there's been a number of challenges to those laws. Again, if the courts get divided on those, then the Supreme Court will step in. Likewise on medical marijuana, the court has weighed in on this one in the past. And to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any current controversies that are heading that way. But several years ago, around 2005, I think, there was a case out of California, right? Several states have authorized medicinal use of marijuana, but marijuana is still a prohibited substance under the federal drug laws, which poses some conflicts between state and federal law enforcement officers. And the Supreme Court sided with the federal government in that case a few years ago. They said, yes, the federal government is perfectly free to ban marijuana, even if, and this case is going to come up in the healthcare suits too, right? Even when we're talking about, because here's who the plaintiff was in this case, it was a terminally ill woman in California who was undergoing chemotherapy for cancer treatment. There were also some other plaintiffs in the case with different medical conditions, but had been authorized by her doctor, right, to obtain marijuana, which she obtained from a friend who grew it for her and provided it to her at no cost. Right, she was not engaged in any form of commerce. She was not buying or selling marijuana, and it certainly wasn't crossing any state lines. It was entirely produced and consumed within the state of California. And so their argument was, why does the federal government have any authority over this? Right, it seems like the people of California could regulate this on their own. But the Supreme Court, in a fairly broad and deferential opinion about the powers of Congress to address national problems, says, no, if Congress thinks certain substances are dangerous and bad for the public health and bad for society, they can be prohibited, right? And if they're prohibited, that prohibition can be applied to everybody, right? And so there are some analogies between this case and the questions of federal power in the healthcare case as well.
What would be the effect of possible recusals by Supreme Court justices on the Affordable Care law?
There's no recusals in this case, right? There's been some arguments that both Justice Kagan and Justice Thomas should recuse themselves in this case, but they have both declined to do so. And this has increased the amount of public attention to the question of the court's recusal practices, right? Essentially, it is up to the individual justices themselves to decide whether they are going to recuse themselves in a particular case. And so, and they do it regularly, right? The justices regularly recuse themselves from individual cases. Kagan, for example, before joining the court, was Solicitor General, which is the third-ranking position in the Federal Justice Department. And so in that position, she worked on a lot of legal disputes from within the Obama administration, right? And any of those cases that she worked extensively on while at the Office of Solicitor General and that have subsequently come to the court, she has recused herself in those cases. In this case, she says she did not work on the healthcare litigation while she was in the office. Justice Thomas, meanwhile, his wife is very active in conservative politics and is employed by an organization affiliated with the Tea Party movement that has played a reasonably prominent role in debates about the healthcare act. And so, again, arguments have been made that he should recuse himself for that reason, but it's just up to the individual justices. There has been some discussion in Congress about whether maybe it should not be up to the individual justices and whether there should be some procedure by which, I don't know who it's going to be, the other justices, right? There's nobody like above them to decide it, right? Is it going to be the other justices that get to decide when somebody's recused? That could create problems as well, too, right? You could have a cabal of justices that forces one justice off the court for a case. That's not perfect either. So, but nobody's recused in the healthcare case. All nine of them are participating.
I'd be willing to be that person to make those decisions. My question goes to the Bush-Gore election case. It seems to me that would be one of these high anxiety cases, as you talked about in the 36-37 election, basically. I know there was a big thing where the Supreme Court also was overriding decisions of the state courts in that case in terms of timing and everything else for the counts, et cetera. It seemed to me that there's some contradictory things there with the conservatives normally wanting to go for high states' rights. In this case, they reversed it for a particular outcome. What I'm going to is, what impact have you seen on the courts because of that type of taking that case and doing what they did and how they did it?
It's interesting. When the case came down, lots of scholars speculated, right? This is going to be terrible for the court, right? We tried to figure out what examples in the court's history could we compare this to, maybe Dred Scott versus Sanford, right? Widely discredited decisions, just terrible efforts by the court to step in and take all power to itself to decide an issue that's dividing the nation, right? To decide the outcome of the presidential election, right? Surely the court's prestige and respect among the public is going to suffer, and this is obviously bad for the court because the court's formal powers are actually fairly limited, right? This is a sort of famous sort of set of scholarly arguments about the court that, right, the court controls neither the purse nor the sword, which is how Alexander Hamilton put it a couple hundred years ago, right? It doesn't control the government's purse strings, and nor does it control the government's law enforcement and military capacities, right? It really just relies upon the authority of its decisions to be respected. And if the court makes a habit of issuing blatantly partisan decisions on sharply divided lines, right, surely its authority is going to suffer. So lots of people thought that was going to happen back in December 2000, and it really hasn't, right? Based on evidence from looking at public opinion surveys where people are asked, you know, what do you think of the Supreme Court? The court's image has not suffered much. Its image is better than most other governmental institutions. It's a lot better than Congress's. And it hasn't suffered very much. And the most persuasive explanation for this that I've seen, which is a little bit weird, but it seems to fit the data, right, is that among Democrats, right, the image of the court did suffer temporarily, right, but it bounced back over time, right? Eventually, people forgot, right, and, you know, the court does other things that we do like, right, and the court, based on one decision, no matter how controversial, right, Democrats did not sort of give up all support for the court. It did take a hit. It went down temporarily, but it rebounded over time. Meanwhile, among Republicans, support for the court went up right away after Bush versus Gore, and has stayed high because the court since then has been a very conservative court that has done a lot of things that Republicans tend to be supportive of, and so the overall numbers never fluctuated that much, right? If anything, the court support for the court has gone up a little bit since Bush versus Gore. The Democrats have maintained their support after taking a brief hit, and Republican support has gone up, and so the overall support for the court has been quite steady.
Professor Tom Keck, thank you very much. We'll be watching and listening very closely.